omigyanatimirandasya gyananjana shalakaya praktur mritam yena tasmai si gurave namaha pancha kalpa turubhyascha kripashindu bhayevacha atitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasude Gaurabhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare So greetings from the Sun Falls. Actually, the town is Stuyvesant Falls. But if you take off the sty, you get Visant. And Visant is a very beautiful Sanskrit word, which means a spring. So, reminds me of Krishna. We're starting a new format today. I think we may have spent the last maybe year and a half, and we studied the Yoga Sutras. Class has been going on for 3.5 years. We've covered many, many substantial texts. And we have a little bit of a new format. One of the reasons we'll have a little bit of a new format is I'm kind of busier than before. And it kind of makes it hard in the middle of the week sometimes to prepare classes if I was going to study a contiguous text. But more than that, sometimes, occasionally, I always try to make the class, but sometimes I may not be here. So the format's going to be a little bit different. Basically, it's called Yoga Reflections. We're going to discuss different pertinent topics in the Bhagavad Gita. We're not going to cover the whole text as we would in a Bhagavad Gita class where we learn the whole. But from the text, we'll take pertinent subjects to discuss. And the format is that I'll speak a little bit about one particular subject. I'll probably read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. And after I discuss it for a while, I'll ask Mahamuni to comment on it or ask questions. So where I normally maybe lecture for 45 minutes to an hour, sometimes I'm amazed how I do that because I can't see the audience, but it's worked out so far. Then this will probably try just to do 15, 20 minutes and then begin in a discussion and look at the point from different angles. Prabhupada said we should every day study the sacred text, the shastras, from different angles. The Bhagavad Gita, it's described like when weapon of detachment, the like an axe. When you study things from different angles, it sharpens your understanding. So I'm hoping we can get deep into various points here that we can discuss. And this would make it an easier format for me to continue the class. Today, I'm going to read some verses from Bhagavad Gita. We're not going to go over the whole thing in context. Maybe most of you know the context, but I can just briefly explain the situation of Arjuna. He's forced to a fratricidal war. Him and his brothers nobly tried to avoid it, but due to the evil-mindedness and aggression of his cousin Duryodhana, finally he's forced to fight. And the Bhagavad Gita begins as the war is about to begin. And it's seen through the eyes of a great mystic, Sanjaya, who's not in the battlefield, but because he's a mystic, he's with Dhritarashtra, who is the father of the evil-minded Duryodhana, who tried to usurp the kingdom of the noble Arjuna and his brothers, and he's seeing the battle, and he's describing to Dhritarashtra what's happening. And Arjuna is about to fight in the war, and Krishna is driving his chariot, and just before the battle begins, Bhishma, Drona, Pramukhata, Krishna brings the chariot of Arjuna to see who's on the other side, and Arjuna sees his military guru, Dronacharya. He sees his beloved grandfather. He sees so many relatives. And then he faces a identity or existential crisis. He doesn't know which way to turn. And he has to deeply reflect on what he should be doing. In Sanskrit, that's called dharma. Dharma means duty. It also means intrinsic nature, because what your duty is based on who you are. So he's faced with this crisis, which puts into confusion his conception of himself. The wrong conceptions don't work, and eventually they'll be tested. So he has this breakdown. So I thought it'd just be appropriate just to read a little bit about that, and then I'll go into the discussion. So this is what happens. When the son of Kunti, Arjuna, saw all those different grades of friends and relatives, he became overwhelmed with compassion and spoke thus. So he's talking to Krishna. My dear Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before me in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering and my mouth drying up. My whole body is trembling. My hair is standing on end. My bow, Gandiva, is slipping from my hand. And my skin is burning. I am now unable to stand here any longer. I'm forgetting myself and my mind is reeling. I see only causes of misfortune. O Krishna, killer of the Keshi demon. And maybe I'll just read this commentary, and then we'll begin a discussion. So Arjuna is having some type of breakdown. And really beautiful in this purport, and I think it's one of the words I'd like to discuss, is nimittani viparitani, where you face a situation where whichever way you turn, there's no hope. Purport, due to his impatience, Arjuna was unable to stay on the battlefield and he was forgetting himself on account of this weakness of his mind. Excessive attachment to material thing puts a man in such a bewildering condition of existence. Vayam dutiya vinivesita shat. Such fearfulness and a loss of mental equilibrium take place in persons who are too affected by material conditions. Arjuna envisioned only painful reverses in the battlefield. He would not be happy even by gaining victory over the foe. So he's saying if he fights, then the people he wants to enjoy the world with are killed. And he questions if that's right. And if he avoids the battle, then he's failing in his duty to protect others from the horrible aggressions of the other side. So he's in a dilemma. The words nimittani viparitani are significant. When a man sees only frustrations in his expectations, he thinks, why am I here? Everyone is interested in himself and his own welfare. No one is interested in the Supreme Self. Arjuna is showing ignorance of his real self-interest by Krishna's will. One's real self-interest lies in Vishnu or Krishna. The conditioned soul forgets this and therefore suffers material pains. Arjuna thought his victory in the battle will only be a cause of lamentation for him. So, I guess maybe for this class, the next few classes, maybe we can focus on Arjuna's dilemma and see something common in it. I know myself, when I came to spiritual life, and initially my parents didn't have a perspective on Eastern religions. They opposed what I was doing. So I was challenged because I felt strongly that my duty was to deepen my understanding of the self, but at the same time, I was threatened with losing the affection of those close to me if I did it. And therefore, I mean, that's just a common challenge, an existential dilemma of really what is your prime identity. So we may focus on Arjuna's things from different angles, his identity, his existential crisis. I would like to just focus on it today. I mean, this is my inspiration of adversity and Dharma. Adversity and Dharma. Dharma means, again, intrinsic nature, our duty. I remember that Srila Prabhupada said a very interesting thing. Someone asked him, what's the difference between a human being and an animal? And Prabhupada answered, he said that a human being can ask, why I am suffering. And from that, there was a very interesting progression. Because when you ask the question, why I am suffering, then from that question of why I am suffering, then comes the question of what did I do wrong? Because again, suffering is this incongruence between your nature and your activities. That's what suffering is. Suffering is an indication. Suffering itself is not bad. The cause of suffering is bad. Suffering is just an indication that there's something wrong. Suffering is a impetus for some kind of proper alignment. So you ask the question, why I'm suffering, then naturally the question is, what did I do wrong? Then if you ask the question, what did I do wrong, then you have to ask the question, what should I be doing? And if you ask the question, what should I be doing, then you have to ask the question, who you are. Because what you should be doing is based on your dharma, your intrinsic nature, what you're made of and what you're made for. So the adversity of Arjuna, it's archetypal because unless one, well, because the world is a suffering place, and adversity just reveals it. adversity, but there was a very nice, not an, I don't think it's a nice experiment, but it was an experiment with a frog, and they put the frog in, there was this water that was very hot, and there's water that was boiling. And they put this frog first in the boiling water, and the frog immediately came out and put in the water that was, they put it in the water that is just boiling somewhat, and not boiling, just hot, the frog that became used to it, and then the frog died. So it's something like that, that as long as the purusha or the soul not living in its own nature, its own spiritual nature, and is identifying with the mind and the body, then there's always duality, because that's a temporary situation, and your identity is always threatened with non-existence. So, so the situation, we get used to it, but the adversity of the world is designed to impel one to really seek deeper into some solution for that. So, yeah, there's just like, I'll just say a few more things, and then we'll have some discussion. There's a dichotomy between pleasure and happiness. Happiness is a condition of the mind. So one can be stimulated and do things that satisfy one's attachment. But if those attachments, if they're not dharma, if one is not acting in an appropriate way, then the mind becomes degraded. And in this perspective, what suffering is suffering is a perception. It's not a reality. It's just like if I was sick and I was suffering from some disease, or if I was very healthy, but I had a dream, and in the dream I was dreaming that I was ill. The problem would not be my condition, but it would be my perception. So as long as one looks at that, the mind is a lens by which one perceives the world. So as long as that lens is distorted by egotism, then one will see the world in a distorted way. And because one sees the world in a distorted way, then one will be in a fearful condition. So one can satisfy an attachment, but if it's egotistical, it's not dharma, it's not the appropriate thing to do, then the mind will become further distorted and one will become further in anxiety. At the same time, if one faces adversity and one responds in the appropriate way to it, that even though one is facing adversity, that adversity can be used to move the mind to a more pure state, a more original state, and make the mind a better instrument, because dharma will move. When you actually do the appropriate thing, it will move the mind to a higher condition and a higher level of perception, and therefore a higher level of happiness. So when adversity and difficulty is there, and one is versed in Dharma, it makes one, because the external situations are difficult, it forces one to look for happiness in the condition of the mind rather than the objects of one's perception. So Arjuna's crisis, his difficulty, and who put him in the difficulty? Krishna didn't put him in the difficulty, but Krishna accelerated his crisis in one sense by putting the chariot before the other army to impel him to try to understand things deeply. And this is what happens when people are in an adverse or suffering condition. If they stay simply on that platform of perception and don't try to understand things, and don't try to understand more deeply, they suffer. So I think the point I'm trying to bring out here in terms of Arjuna's situation is that his condition, it's a condition that one will have to come to unless they're on the platform of the soul. Because as long as you're identifying with the body and the mind, there is duality. And the duality is that the more you become attached to that situation, ultimately, the more fear you'll have of losing it. And ingrained in everything you do is that duality, that it's temporary. So on that situation, it says nimittani viparitani, on that situation, purely the material situation, that type of identification, then one is going to come to that situation that whatever you do is a cause of misfortune. Because if you don't satisfy your attachments, you suffer. And if you simply satisfy your attachments and become more engrossed in the body, you also suffer. You suffer the fear that it's temporary. So this is Arjuna's basic crisis. Anyway, the class will take time to get more focused. But Muni, you can make some comment on the situation. I think this is exactly why I'm having you help, but I don't want to get it.
Mark, do you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
I guess maybe before I ask a couple questions, I there's a number of things you said, and I want to make sure that I just understood them properly.
Okay, yeah.
That seemed to me that you're taking your point of departure here for your discussion is that Arjuna finds himself in a situation where he feels like whatever he does, he's going to be unhappy. And that's somehow the trigger for the whole Bhagavad Gita. That's the trigger for his questions and Krishna's answers. And so if I understood correctly, what you're trying to do is illustrate how Dharma, or the notion of the right thing that we should do, ties in with these kind of distressful or these kind of dilemmas. And again, if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that the world is just such, for whatever reason, the way the world is. Do you hear me, Marsh?
I'm listening.
Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, the phone. I didn't know if the phone went out.
Yeah.
The world is somehow that if we have a fairly narrow-minded approach to things where we're kind of going after pleasure or try to avoid pain, the world is generally going to put us in a difficult circumstance. And at that point, we have the opportunity to reflect on the best kind of response. Now, according to the yoga traditions, according to the Shastra, the best response is one that's in accord with Dharma, our religious or moral duty. And if we can respond that way, what happens is that we begin to internalize this deeper understanding, not merely going after pleasure and avoiding pain, but we start to see the world according to Dharma, according to the right way of doing things, which gives us a certain kind of orientation, so we're not confused in the way we were before. But it also brings us to a kind of level of mental satisfaction, because we have a kind of, our vision becomes more pure, and as it becomes more pure, a number of the things which bothered us, maybe we see are no longer really objects of difficulty. Did I understand? Is that more or less?
Yeah, that's more or less. I think it's good that we discuss this way. Go ahead.
So I guess the first question, Marge, I have is, you know, do you think that the kind of crisis that Arjuna is facing is the kind of thing that we may not always be bewildered like Arjuna, but do you think it's a sign of a kind of, I guess what I'm asking is, sometimes I feel like we can get complacent in our lives. I certainly can. And there's a way in which maybe if you're really properly focused and if you're working hard in your dharma or in your practice, you may be forced to confront things and deal with more, in one sense, deal with more turbulence. And is it a sign of being progressive that that it's not uncommon that you have to undergo these kind of internal reflections, even sometimes painful reflections, or is it really just a sign of ignorance?
Well, you know, the example is always given of, you know, you sweep the attic and more dust comes up. So there is a sense, that when you want to go deep, because what does deeper mean? What deeper means is that you give up attachments that are detrimental to the development of your mind in a higher spiritual way. And therefore, you know, what is pain? Pain is the giving up of attachments. So if one actually tries to bring himself to a higher condition of perception and happiness, part of it is going to be a challenge. You know, a challenge to give up certain actions that are not dharmic, that are, they're not in one's best interest. So, you know, there's going to be some, and what I guess the Bhagavad Gita is bringing out is that the world is so constructed and our relationship with God is so constructed that we will be put into situations that call for us to internalize and understand things in a more deep way and accept things that perhaps are against our makeup or attachments, and to reject things sometimes that we like. I mean, anyone who's engaged in any type of practice, just like before this, I was meditating, so I had to give up my time, I had to give up my whim, you know, and I had to sit down, I had to control my mind, you know, and anytime you want to go to the next step and get deeper in your understanding, it requires. And that's what liberation is. Just like in the days of yore, they had the example of the great warriors who, you know, they didn't meditate their whole life, but at the end of their life, because they had this understanding, this spiritual understanding of the goal of life is to realize the soul, and that eventually, in an appropriate way, you have to give things that are external to the soul. And again, we can't make the misunderstanding that this means renunciation. We know very well that part of Dharma is understanding very clearly what your attachments are and how to satisfy them in the appropriate way. Not that you just give up all your attachments, you know. But at the same sense, the ultimate goal, if you're on a yogic path, the ultimate goal is to just live selflessly and in a situation of pure love. and just to abide in the soul. So the Kshatriyas in the day of yore, they would, you know, walk to the north. And what was the first thing they would do? They would, you know, break their sword and take off their, you know, I'm not really a general. Then they walk to the north, perform austerities, and eventually amalgamate everything that's external to the soul. So in any spiritual path, that's the eventual goal, and there's a process to do it. And it's difficult to break the sword. You know, they're a soldier, they're a warrior, give up the uniform. They work their whole life, they're identified with it. So there's basically kind of like a progression, a very healthy progression. But if you want to move forward, if anyone here is, you know, on the Sangha, is looking at their spiritual life now, you know, there's Dharma. And what the Dharma is there's a next step. And what does that next step entail? That next step entails some sacrifice. And some difficulty. So I think in answer to your question, either by inspiration from hearing knowledge, et cetera, and hearing understanding, or from the way the world is, that is life being confronted with that situation. And because the world is not moving, by definition, the world is not moving according to our desires, it's suffering. Because what is suffering? Suffering is when things are not moving according to your desires. That's suffering. And it's extremely egotistical to think that that's what the world is, that the world is something that's moving. That's what it means to be God. The world's moving according to desire. We're not the controllers, so it's not. So the world is, there is a friction in that world. And unless one changes one's perspective from egotism to attachment, there is going to be suffering. And sometimes the world's going to move, more rapidly against our desires. And what it's saying here, these situations come to impel one to seek a different level of happiness, rather than the external. Anyway, Mooney, something else?
So that makes sense. I mean, I guess...
Yeah.
I guess it's not an uncommon model that even people who are deeply spiritually progressive, they run into crises sometimes. Maybe like some of the most exalted examples would be like some Christian mystics who speak of the dark night of the soul, and somehow at what seems like a very high level of meditation, they feel this emptiness and that God somehow is not available to them the way they'd hope. Now, certainly I'm not anywhere near that stage, but I can relate to the idea that we could be going along our lives, and in some way, you know, there's now a challenge where we feel some kind of suffering because we're now going to have to, as you were saying, take it to another level of practice. But, I mean, it makes sense that we're focusing on this given Arjuna's situation, but sometimes I hear a description that goes something like this, that mature spiritual advancement or even moral advancement is not merely this kind of, you know, grit your teeth struggle, but it's something like, it's a kind of adventure where the beckoning of this greater reality that we want to become associated with, or the beckoning of greater moral excellence or virtue that we want to attain, it inspires us the way an athlete may be inspired, let's say, to run a marathon. Well, there's a kind of pain, but that's really minimal compared to the great enthusiasm and adventurous spirit that one has. And so I guess I'm just trying to think about these two in relationship right now, that they're two different models, or maybe just two different aspects of the same process. But on one hand, I mean, I don't know, it seems to me that we could have vigorous, enthusiastic progress without existential dilemmas. I don't know. Does that make sense, or do you disagree? Do you feel like in one sense it's part of the process that we have to confront our own doubts and things like that?
Well, let's put it this way. Unless you realize your pure identity, there's going to be crises of what your duty is based on who you are. And I think really what happens is that I think they, in other words, I think your question is can you avoid existential dilemmas?
Maybe not avoid them, but yeah, but can are they really necessary for the process? Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah.
It seems that most people are. Well, I don't know. I'm just actually trying to look at it practically. Of people that I know that are very, very spiritually advanced, you know, mm-hmm. and that means they have an extreme desire to realize the self, and just look at what in the Yoga Sutras, what is what's the classic concept of liberation, right? It basically describes there's basically two samskaras in the mind, right? Mm-hmm. This is on the yogic path. Two impressions in the mind. One impression in the mind, right, is I am the body, and this temporary material situation is the all in all, right? And the other mm-hmm. one is that it's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a fine path to really come to the ultimate realization. In other words, I'm saying there's a lot to go through. You know, it's a lot to go through to ultimately become liberated. And let's say someone is on the progressive path. It's like the marathon runner. They'll be challenging their limits, right? And there may be crises, mm-hmm. right? There may be that my muscles are going to give up and I'm not going to, you know. This all, you know, I think that's basically, I'm not sure if you can avoid existential dilemmas if you're not realized. You know?
Well, I remember that.
I'll give you one example. Just like in the Bhagavatam, you know, Maharaj Prickety has 7 days left to live,
mm-hmm.
right? And at the very, very end, right. At the very, very end, after the whole Bhagavatam is spoken, and he gets a very clear conception of who he is, right? And it's taken a lot of teachings, and he only has 7 days left to live. At the very end, then Sukadeva Goswami, when he's instructing him, he apparently gives an opposing conception. And it's very, very confusing, because at the very end, he gives Brahma Gyan rather than Bhakti. And the whole time he's giving bhakti. And when the commentators analyze that, right, and I think this is something, they describe something like, you know, like when you bang a nail, you have to shake it. You know, so that indicates to me that there are, you know, some really, in the spiritual path, there's some really intense efforts required. You know, and they require tests to actually strengthen us. So, I mean, this image that, certainly, if you change your perspective, you change your suffering despite what happens to you. It's just like someone in astrology, so you can have two paths. Like, for example, you may coming under a very difficult period where you're oppressed. Right, but now if you're on the spiritual path, you may look at it in a completely different way. You can look at, oh, this is an opportunity to be humble. So mm-hmm. it's a fact that the perspective you have on things, you know, will change your experience of it. And one who's on a progressive spiritual path, you know, may look at the difficulties they have in a completely different way. I mean, there's even a level of high, high spiritual consciousness where it's described that the greatest difficulties, look at the greatest difficulties which impel one, you know, closer to one's spiritual goal become the greatest joy for one. But it's not that the difficulties are not there, but the perspective is different. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
Just two things. One is I was reminded of, I think Srila Prabhupada once said that if it feels easy to you, then you're doing something wrong. He was describing sadhana like that. But something else. And this would maybe be the final thing that I bring up or ask, and then if there's more you want to say or if you want to open it up to see if Gail or anyone else would like to add anything. We've been speaking on a fairly abstract level right now about dharma and things like that and a sense of what you should do. My question is, how esoteric is it what one's dharma is? You know, and I mean in terms of, like, we people living right now in the modern West or whatever, my impression is that much of what our dharma is fairly obvious upon reflection. Things like take care of your family, be faithful to your spouse, you know what I mean? Don't violate others, you know, dignity, stuff like that. And so, I mean, do you think that generally dharma is fairly clear, but that there are special circumstances like Arjuna's where we really need to get good guidance from those who are wiser to kind of see how to navigate it? Or do you think dharma really generally you need a higher guidance to understand?
Well, let me just say, I just want to say something about dharma and maybe it'll become clearer. And,
okay.
So dharma means what? It means duty. What's your duty? Your duty is based on what you are. You know, so your ultimate dharma is spiritual. But because we are by karma encased in a body and a mind with certain desires, we have choices to make. And then, as we know, we can't indulge without restriction or attachments, because they'll bring the consciousness external. And renounce things artificially, then you think of the object of your attachment even more. So there's a process of who you are and what you are, what you should be doing. And in each case, the science of dharma, in other words, what dharma means is those actions which can bring you closer to a understanding of the self. In each case, what dharma is, it's actually the science of response to whatever situation you're in individually. And, of course, there are basic moral principles, but there's also individuals' decisions to take. It's the science of response, and that's the glory of the sacred text. You have a science for it that moves you in a favorable way to elevate the mind, to move towards a pure and purer conception of your intrinsic nature, and to dwell in that intrinsic nature as a spiritual loving connection with God. Your question is what we've been saying is dharma.
Well, that, you know, you were talking about responding in the appropriate way to circumstances. And I just have a sense that for most people who are not somehow severely damaged emotionally or intellectually or whatever, generally what our dharma is fairly clear. You know, relate in the right sorts of ways with your family and friends and other people, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was wondering if, you know, we've been talking about dharma in an abstract way. I was wondering if, you know, we only really need to get special guidance in terms of our dharma when conflicts arise or when ambiguity arises, or do you think, generally speaking, we need a kind of higher guidance just to have a sense of what our dharma is as we go through our daily lives?
I think the choices become finer and finer. When I first came to spiritual life, I remember I was in California, and I met, you know, my tradition, and I was sitting there with four friends, you know, and the discussion of one of my friends with the monk who was sitting with us is my friend, thought that sex life was spiritual, and you know, that sex life is spiritual, and that to the extent that there can be no restriction on it. You know, so that had to be cleared up, that in spiritual life, there's certain regulation of one impulses. But, okay, so that was a question of what is my duty. But as you proceed, there's always questions like that, because if you understand how the mind works in spiritual life, the decisions become more and more subtle. So there's always a question of that. What is the action that will most be favorable to myself and others? So I think that as one progresses in life, there's always decisions like that to be taken until one has complete realization and understanding. There's always decisions like that. And well, it amazes me. Go ahead.
No, please. No, you were about to say something. I'm sorry. Please.
So what are you going to say? Go ahead.
No, I'm not necessarily, I think that either way that I'm framing this would agree with that. I guess here's my deep question, Marsh. I sometimes think that people who are involved in guru-centered spirituality, when they're not mature about it, they can be reduced to a kind of permanent state of, like, adolescence, where their idea is, I just can't make my mind for myself. I have to go ask somebody who knows more than me. And maybe it's some all-knowing teacher, or at least mostly knowing teacher. My impression is that a better way to see things is that one needs to learn how to internalize and make the right decisions by one's own practice, turning to teachers when it's required. But the goal is not to kind of always have someone within the reach of your cell phone. It's to develop your own moral intuition, so to speak. I apologize that I know I'm now saying this is a little bit different from what I was saying, but that's, I think, what the deep motivation for my question here. And it might be more appropriately discussed after we see Krishna and Arjuna, you know, Arjuna surrendering to Krishna and things like that. Maybe that'll be a better context of the Gita to think about this. But that's kind of the deep, that's kind of what's in the background of my mind right now.
Yeah, well, I would say, I mean, and your teacher always said that, right? That, you know, you're supposed to not surrender your intelligence, but surrender with intelligence. It's just like when there's a child, right? When there's a very, very young child, what does the child lack? He lacks buddhi or intelligence, right? So the mother and father have to be very protective, and they have to serve as the child's intelligence. But what a good parent does is train up the child's intelligence. And when the child has a developed intelligence and the child has also learned to be obedient to authority, not just by position, authority by knowledge, and the child's learned, then the parent transfers that obedience to himself to the child. In other words, gives the child initiative and freedom to be obedient to his own intelligence. So what the teacher is supposed to do is train up the intelligence. So I think that's, you know, you train up the intelligence because it's just very practical, because people have to make decisions. And when people make decisions, they're the ones that have the information to make those decisions. When you're making a decision, generally, you know, a good counselor, I've seen this, a good counselor, you know, helps people make their own decisions, because generally the person himself has the experience, the knowledge of his situation or her situation to make that decision. So I don't think a teacher, that's a very, very good teacher. But at the same time, in that process, that, you know, where someone is training up their intelligence and has the frame of reference and understanding to solve their own problems and the intelligence to do so, there are situations of complexity where one is not sure, like Arjuna, of what their dharma is. And that is one. I mean, that's Arjuna's situation, that his duty is to fight because he's supposed to protect others from harm. and his family's on the other side. And so what does he do? And on what basis does he do it? And, you know, it's very interesting in the Bhagavad Gita what you learn. You see, I mean, he's supposed to fight for many, many reasons, but it's on every level, beginning with the soul, that the soul is part of God, and it's a complex issue, but it's there's complexities that are involved, and those complexities, what happens when someone's in a particular situation and they're confused, and what are they confused about? What is the appropriate way, if they're sincere, what is the appropriate way to respond? And what is the mentor or teacher supposed to do? The teacher is one who has experience and knowledge based on the sacred texts, right? That can help a person in that particular situation. So I don't think it's practical or even healthy to listen, you know, to constantly go to someone. But at the same time, there will be times where people need clarification because there's complexities. But at the same time, the relationship with the teacher it forms other functions too. But that's another question. Okay.
Okay. All right, Marsh. I can show.
Anybody else have any questions? Please, you know, this is a first time for us in this format, and the way these things generally work now is now that we've done it in this way. Now I'll speak to Mahamuni. I do that anyway when I give a class. Especially the first class is just testing the waters, and then you get the realization how it should be given. So what we'll do now is we'll talk about it and really now clarify really what are the issues, and then probably the next class we'll just make a summary after thinking about it clearly with the issues, and we'll go on to some other ones. Anybody else have a question?
No, I think that was really good and just gave me a lot to chew
on.
Ollie? Yeah.
Oh, okay. You're giving us some feedback. Thank you. Do you have any questions, Ollie?
No questions. Just a lot to meditate on. That was really a beautiful exchange. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, we hope you'll be joining us regularly.
I plan on it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, anybody else like to say hello?
Hello?
Who's that?
It's me and somebody else, Gail and somebody else.
Okay, we'll first say Gail. Gail, you have any questions?
No.
No. That's unusual, but that's good. Thank you. Okay, who is the someone else would like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. It's Hanan from Gainesville.
Who is it? Oh.
Hanan. From Gainesville, from Alachua.
Say that name again. Spell it for me.
Hanan, H-A-N-A-N.
Oh, Hanan. Okay, thank you. Thank you. I met you first in Israel, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we'll end for today, and we'll resume again next week. It'll be at 8 o'clock, a little bit earlier. And, okay, thank you.